All right, let me get started anyway. This is another work in progress. So the target I wear standing up here presenting some what I think is some fresh information should have a somewhat of a spatterproof screen over it. I'm not quite ready yet to say this is the absolute gospel. A lot of this are things that you're going to have to make your own minds up about from hearing the oral evidence, which will come fairly late in the paper, but stand by, we're really going someplace with this. The record industry has undergone many changes during its 100-plus year span. The most audibly striking is that from the system which employed the recording horn to that based on using the microphone during the 1924-1926 period. Almost unrecognized, however, is a shift of equal importance. Few consider it remarkable that now and for many years into the past, records were made by one group of companies, the playback equipment mostly by others. Yet until the early 30s, the outfit that made the discs also dominated the market with a full phonographic line. That's not to say there weren't other manufacturers as expiring patents permitted, but the principal machine sales belonged to those people who also made the records. In the US, the period through the mid-teens belongs almost exclusively to Victor, Columbia, and Edison, software and hardware makers all, a patent-wielding oligarchy whose grip loosened somewhat during the years preceding the introduction of electrical recording as their controlling patents expired. The only significant competitor in records and in machines emerging from this decade was Brunswick. The first half of the 1920s saw the establishment of radio in the home and the great success of silent film at the movie palace. The second half, the arrival of the talkie and further inroads by the broadcasters. Radio spawned a plethora of technological advances which spread throughout the communications and entertainment industries and deeply affected the world of sound recording. We record collectors believe that the record companies exist to sell discs with artists performing pieces of music. This may have been true for some of the smaller fry, but surely for Victor, this was the lesser portion of the business. Overhead one mic? No, there it is. This chart of Victor sales has been widely reprinted and will be familiar to some of you. A careful look shows an interesting picture. The second overhead, please. Here are the same figures entered into a spreadsheet which then computes the various numbers under their appropriate headings. And this is included in the handout. This overhead clearly shows that from 1909, with the dominance of the inside horn Victrola established through 1929, the instrument business clearly exceeded that of the records by a significant margin. And from 1913 on, by an average of over 20%. The only 2 years during this period when this was not the case were 1922, the aftermath of a depression period, and the year of Victor's disastrous credenza design, and 1925, when the factory was closed for retooling for the orthophonic system. Overhead three, please. If this were divided similarly but by profits, I suspect the gap would be far wider. Victor, the solid lines are machine sales. The straight lines with the points are record sales. Assuming Victor came out ahead on a $50 tabletop, imagine the markup when the nearly identical mechanism was included in the rest of the line, which ran up to $1,000 per instrument. My family was in the furniture manufacturing business. I can assure you it didn't cost that much more to make a fancier cabinet. Victor was a furniture manufacturer first. The sales numbers prove it. The playing mechanisms, the records, the intensive advertising of their operatic stars all led to a demand for the boxes. Not that the records were sold as loss leaders, far from it. Still, it was instrument sales which would prevail in any conflict which affected the company's bottom line. Their furniture market had to be protected, even if it meant delaying or suppressing an improvement in recorded sound. The trick at Victor was to make a bunch of Victrolas and sell them all. And Victor did this year after year with little residual inventory and considerable order backlog until the 1920s when A, radio struck, and B, the traditional Victrola line was expanded late in 1921 to include Lowboy Credenza models. Overhead four, please. Victor's design to stay abreast of trends in home decoration included raised tops over the playback compartment to prevent the placement of a vase on the surface, which might interfere with access to the phonograph lid. This at Eldridge Johnson's personal insistence. The public didn't like the line at all, and the inventory of humpbacks piled up. Barely 10% of those produced were sold at retail price. In later model years, the top was flattened out, but the damage had been done, particularly to 1922's bottom line. The experiments necessary to develop a system in which electricity was used to record commercially and to play back these products in the home, so the casual listener would easily notice an improvement over his older mechanical recordings, covered about 7 years, from 1919 through 1926. Maxfield and Harrison, engineers in the employ of the Western Electric Company, discussed the concept of matched electrical impedances in various papers which cover the development of the electrical recording process. This theory holds that energy should flow in one direction only, that energy diverted in any other direction results in distortion. The sources of electrical energy were defined and their interrelationships expressed in a series of equations. Overhead five, please. These engineers then prepared a table listing each of these sources and their mechanical equivalents and applied the same equations, substituting mechanical for electrical values. The result was the orthophonic sound reproduction system, which included a reproducing head and a horn design, which Victor further elaborated into a folded horn design. It applied rigid mathematical formulas to what had been an intuitive art, with science plugged in appropriate places as various phenomena became better understood. Slide six, please. These new machines, introduced late in 1925, allowed some of the microphone-made electrical recording improvements to be heard, particularly the lower portions of the frequency spectrum, which distorted badly on the older Victrolas. Slide seven, please. The new design not only extended the actual range downward, it reduced the generation of unruly resonances and kept those lower frequencies from interfering with each other. Orthophonic phonographs were the Tickle Me Elmo of the 1925 Christmas season, propelling sales well into the next year and, according to some insiders, saving the company. These improvements created a transitional upgrade which bought the industry time to develop and tool up for a new mechanism which would use the fuller possibilities inherent in electrical playback of electrical recordings. The complete system required a pickup which translated mechanical stylus motion into an electrical signal in a magnetic field, an electrically operated device for generating sound waves in the air, the loudspeaker, and an amplifier to strengthen this signal so the resulting electrical current could power a magnet attached to the speaker's cone and cause it to move back and forth efficiently enough to give a more accurate reproduction of the sound wave than any horn had managed. Overhead seven, please. Do we have overheads? Remove overhead seven is what I should have said. The stylus moves from side to side when cutting the lateral groove. This restricted bass frequencies capturable by the old process, limited the groove width necessary to accommodate these frequencies, and allowed a playing time on the 12-inch disc of over 4 minutes. Lower frequencies added by electrical recording required a wider swing of the cutting stylus to capture these added notes than was possible with records whose lower frequencies were limited by the recording horn. If the same feed screw controlled track width was used to keep playing times to the same length as the previous records, these wider excursions would cut into adjacent grooves. Yet from a competitive standpoint, playing time could not be reduced no matter how much the sound was improved as a result, or the record would have played for a minute and a half as opposed to the competitor's 4 minutes. This is for the 12-inch records. In a brilliant flash of insight, and I really admire the guys who thought of this, the Bell Lab staff came up with electrically reducing the bass when the record was being made, and since there was now a way of altering the reproduction of the frequency spectrum with an amplifier, adding it back during playback. This is what Gary had a paper on last year about equalization. There were other attributes to this as well concerning the upper frequencies. A further difficulty had to be overcome. The recording system Victor used meant that in terms of constant groove speed, the outside was going much more slowly than the inside, just the way a tire rotates. There was a loss of bass as the cutter neared the label area. Given the expanded bass response the electrical system made possible, this discrepancy became quite noticeable, particularly for a symphonic piece when you went from one record, the end of one record, to the beginning of the next, a continuous piece of music. To correct for this, the sound from the recording head passed through a resistor with an adjustable slide, which was connected with a pawl to the overhead feed screw. As the cutter approached the center, more bass was introduced. Thus, the audio quality was the same from the end of one side to the beginning of the next. This is called diameter equalization and was a problem as well with all horn-made recordings in addition. Does anyone know if any of those presently making commercial reissues of acoustical recordings compensate for this loss? This was written before this conference. In talking with Dennis Rooney, I understand that this is now being done on as required by the Columbia engineers in their restoration work. Western Electric played their new process to Victor executives for the first time in 1923. From the Philharmonic's dated experimental discs, which we will come to in a moment, we know that the audio quality at that time, though clear, lacked the complete fullness and loudness of which they were shortly to become capable. The telephone engineers nonetheless considered the sound a substantial enough improvement over the acoustic system to warrant a demonstration. Victor and RCA generated various company histories over the years, some for in-house use only. That by Aldrich in his 1964 version, there were earlier ones still in the Victor files, is published in Bill Moran's Victor Matrix Discography, Volume 1, in minuscule type, but published. The papers he used and many others, drafts, and much other data from which his account is drawn, that is Aldrich's, are at RCA's archive in the Bertelsmann building in New York, though I understand, is Cynthia here? At any rate, she told me yesterday they don't really have much of this paperwork, they being the present owners of the record company, and at the Hagley Museum and Library in Wilmington, Delaware, where I researched a great deal of this presentation. Aldrich interviewed Walter Clark by phone in 1953. He had been in charge of Victor's artist and repertory department during this transition period, dictated a memo to Aldrich, which I paraphrase. Clark says that there had been a test of the new system in 1923. Those in attendance, Harry Sui, in charge of recording, Clarence Wicks, head of record manufacturer, and J.S. McDonald, head of sales, were not impressed. They called the results distorted, barrelly. B-A-R-R-E-L-E-Y, a word that my spell checker had continually problems with. Only the A&R department and the memo's author, Walter Clark, saw the possibilities in the new process, which Victor declined. Chances are this demo took place on Western Electric's site. The first orthophonic horn was produced early in 1924. So if Clark's year is correct, these examples were probably played on a late model Victrola. The bass energy, even in these less than optimum 1923 electrical recordings, would have overwhelmed the then current playback system. And for a company as historically conservative as Victor, the thought of the need to redesign the entire record and manufacturing facility when its two major competitors, Columbia and Edison, were known to be failing, on the ropes actually, and radio's sound was still fraught with technical and regulatory problems, it would have seemed irresponsible indeed. By late 1924, things had changed. Radio was being aggressively promoted, selling well, and showed signs of sonic improvement. The vacuum tube amplifier simplified the process of using the radio, though static, tuning difficulties, and overlapping broadcast bands were still a problem. Victor was losing financially hurtful market share to the upstart. Another demonstration, this time on Victor's premises, took place, and Victor signed up. But not before Columbia, now owned by its English counterpart under Louis Sterling's leadership, did some intensive lobbying with Western Electric and obtained equal rights. Some of Victor's competitive advantage was thus lost to his old-time rival. One more factor must be taken into account. Johnson suffered serious and long bouts of depression all his adult life. This is Eldridge Johnson, the president of Victor. And in early February 1925, he had a complete nervous breakdown. From his standpoint, the Credenza failure, followed by the cascading technological complexity of the new developments his company faced, must have been overwhelming. Radio, two new recording systems, the orthophonic and the electrical continuation of it, the need to shut the furniture factories for a year with attendant layoffs and loss of company income while preparing for orthophonic production, and the rescue of Columbia by Sterling and their sharing of the Western Electric improvements must have been a serious blow to Johnson. He exercised no further executive powers from Victor's premises thereafter. His lieutenants were aging poorly as well. Bradford Royal had serious angina. The top level of Victor management was in flux with no clear lines of authority during the acoustic electric transition period. Many able department heads, rudderless, began a series of turf wars, which were continued on a somewhat subdued level even after a three-man committee was put together, which included Johnson's son, who voted his father's controlling stock. They succeeded in drawing the company's inner resources sufficiently together so that it could be put onto the market. Serious negotiations began mid-November of 1926 with the banking group that eventually acquired it. No doubt, preliminary conversations which led to the sale took place beforehand. These events occur right in the middle of the time period we're discussing. Electrical recording should be seen as a step in an imaginative evolutionary continuum well planned by AT&T's executives, from the microphone, which is derived from the telephone, to radio, which added an electrical sound amplification system, to our interest here, the electrical record, to films synchronized with electrically recorded discs. Just as practical implementation of Edison's electric light bulb required a stable power generating and distribution system, electrical recording needed more than a microphone. It required a group of interrelated inventions. These included a device to convert the sound coming from the microphone to activate a cutting head, the cutting head itself, an amplifier suitable for increasing the small electric signal from that head, and a way to put extra frequencies at both ends of the scale onto a master disc without shortening playing time or increasing the record size. These last two basic electronic appliances could be as large and draw as much power as it took to do the job, since this was laboratory equipment for ultimate use in a factory. For home use, however, the playback head could not be so heavy that it destroyed the new record. The necessary amplifier and built-in re-equalization circuit had to fit comfortably into a furniture cabinet and had to operate reliably on the normal electrical supply of the period, and what we now call a loudspeaker had to be developed. AT&T owned the patents and administered its empire. Bell Labs performed its experimental work, and its Western Electric made the products. As radio developed, Western Electric sold professional broadcast equipment all over the US and elsewhere. WEAF in New York was their most visible and audible showcase. In that summer of 1922, this station broadcast a group of outdoor concerts with the New York Philharmonic. In November, they began an indoor series with this orchestra, as was the case in the year following as well. The 1923-24 series was thus available to Bell Labs as a once-removed sound source over telephone lines into which they could plug to get all those sonic attributes so difficult to capture using the horn: extended bass, higher frequencies, widened dynamic range, greater sonic detail, and so forth. Access to a high-quality broadcast signal relieved the experimenters of the need for finding live musicians when they ran tests. They could simply tune in their own programs, where they certainly determined the mic setup and other technical matters to allow a controlled result. By getting at the signal before it went to the transmitter, they were not at the mercy of the atmospheric interference which plagued the early days of radio reception. These experiments were recorded for later evaluation. In 1923, there was no such thing as an acetate blank. Thank you, Michael. They had to be taken on wax the same way commercial records were, plated and pressed before what had been recorded could be heard. It is uncertain as to how many were made of each of these experiments, but there was no need for more than perhaps half a dozen of each, and few have survived. Now, a shift in time. In 1977, as part of my project building the sound archive at the New York Philharmonic, I compiled a list which included the date of each broadcast, the program content, and the sequence, and all performers, beginning with that 1922 Lewison Stadium series. A few years ago, I received a call from David Lennick, a Canadian collector, who had found some unusual records at the late Jim Hatfield's record barn in Messina, New York. Jim had bought a large group of discs at the Deansboro Musical Museum auction. David uncovered a group of test pressings, many of them oversized, dated in the area outside the label, but otherwise uninformative. He borrowed and played them, recognized a number of the classical pieces they contained, and called me to see if my old radio program magazine collection could help identify them. Many turned out to be from that 1923-24 season and fit precisely the list I had made for the Philharmonic, and on which the Philharmonic holds copyright, that list. Overhead 8, please. Needless to say, I dropped everything and drove to Messina, bought what records were still there from this group, mostly scratched or cracked, only to find that some Texas cowboy had preceded me there by a few days and bought the intact ones. Kurt was kind enough to offer to trade them to me in exchange for, well, we finally did the deal after an intricate negotiation. They now belong to the New York Philharmonic, courtesy of an anonymous donor. Some will be released shortly as part of a new CD series the orchestra is initiating. Contact them for details. Content is still being finalized. Most of us have assumed improvement in 78 fidelity from the acoustic through the various changes in the electrical process was evolutionary. The sound coming from the commercial pressings to which we have all accessed is the source of this assumption. Thanks to the generosity of the record manufacturers, which allows researchers access to original session data, we now know when most discs were recorded and can line up a group into chronological sequence. We think we discover that as sessions followed one on another, dynamic and frequency ranges kept expanding. Sibilants became more pronounced. There was gradual improvement in the illusion of the sound of massed instruments in a room or concert hall, and a greater ability to capture the audio signatures of those instruments which were badly treated by the old recording horn. This sequence would lead us to believe that by October 1927, when recordings of the symphony orchestra first fully caught the rich 78 sound we now take for granted, the sonic art remained, with a technological tweak now and then, pretty much the same until 1945 or so, when the use of tape recording led to the LP. Much of this thinking is based on what we hear when we play these discs back on high-quality audio systems. But when the equipment on which they were reproduced when they were new is considered, as well as the economic and political forces within the industry, and the distribution patterns of electrical power as this company was in the throes of complete urban and rural electrification, still a decade from completion during the mid-1920s, a different picture emerges. Here are portions of three versions of Wagner's Flying Dutchman Overture. The first made via the recording horn with Landon Ronald leading the new symphony orchestra was recorded by HMV in 1914. Next comes the New York Philharmonic under Mengelberg from a broadcast of April 2, 1924. Finally, the same forces in their October 6, 1925 Victor Electrical recording. Overhead 9, please. And may we have the examples? How am I doing on time? Okay, I've got probably another 10 minutes after this.
You do?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, okay.
Okay, there's 5 minutes of this. And then another 5 or 10 minutes. Now the broadcast. Now, a year and a half later, the commercial electrical recording. As you can see, oh, I have this on, fine. There's a previous record of this, April 17th, 1924, unissued. No test pressings have turned up as far as I know, certainly not at the Philharmonic. I assume you noted that the Ronald lacks definition in the timpani. You can barely hear them. Brass instruments are substituted for some of the lower strings. The acoustic is non-reverberant. The broadcast, though a bit distant, is full and rich. The ambience of instruments playing in a hall is my personal most striking initial impression. The upper frequencies, which define the sound of massed French horns, trombones, etc., is the clear and deep timpani, the truer approximation of the sound of a complete string section, the greater dynamic range allowing a finer degree of dynamic shading, all contribute to a far more realistic impression of the large symphony orchestra. What are we to make of the third example, taken down by the greatest professional recording engineers in the country? Though the frequency range is appreciably widened and the timpani are better defined than in the acoustically made disc, there's a serious loss of all the presence we now know the system was capable of taking down. The strings are half the strength of the normal symphony orchestra. As you can see in the specs at the top there, there are 8 first violins instead of the normal 14 or 16. Not 8 pairs, for instance. I think it is clear the ultimate quality of which this system was capable was held back deliberately. Because no equipment was then on the market to reproduce the much better sounding recordings properly, or at least not enough of it as compared with the installed base of old Victrolas on which playback of this disc with all its new attributes emphasized would have resulted in great distortion and terrible record sales. But we can hear clearly when the commercially offered Western Electric system was fully employed, the sound of sound changed forever. By placing the instruments at a greater distance from the microphone than was necessary with the recording horn, tones were blended by room reflection. A greater degree of accuracy during playback was required for this quality to enhance the listening experience rather than debase it. This was the improvement which had to await the wide availability of the vacuum tube amplifier and magnet-driven loudspeaker before a record dared be marketed which could properly exploit the new recording system. It didn't sound terrible on the orthophonic system, just not as well. The change in acoustical ambience is one of the roots of Reed and Welch's objections in their book From Tinfoil to Stereo, to electrical recordings, and poisons considerable portions of their technical analysis. There were other advantages to the new system, not quite as startling, but which further expanded the listening experience. The mechanical recording method encountered great difficulty with massed instruments, particularly with those including strings, in presenting a smooth, even response over the duration of diminuendos and crescendos. A problem virtually eliminated, according to insiders at the company who were working on the system, eliminated by the electrical recording process. That's not strictly true. If you listen carefully to some of these early records, the early good electrical records from 1927 and so forth, you can still hear a certain amount of clumsiness. It's unclear as to whether it's the recording engineers turning a knob to make a diminuendo or whether it's the conductor actually holding back his forces. And there are some places where the diminuendo still occurs like stepwise. Some of the exaggerations in Stokowski's 1927 remake of the New World Symphony, that is after the first electrical one that was issued in, that comes out just about this time, that's the next day following this in Philadelphia. But his remake in 27 were probably deliberately contrived to demonstrate the system's more flexible dynamics, though there are still awkwardnesses. It is hard to tell if some crescendi is introduced by Stokowski or by the control room. It is often clear, however, it is not Dvorak. In November 1926, Victor came out with its first group of electrical reproducing phonographs. In a widely publicized and well-coordinated marketing campaign, they also offered their newest record releases on the new scroll labels. From here on out, if the sound could be made better, it was made better. It's hard for us to imagine that at one time every nook and cranny of this country wasn't equipped with wall plugs through which power flowed, but many cities electrified their business and theater districts first, then the well-to-do neighborhoods. Poor folks got electricity last unless their neighborhoods were in the path of the wiring trucks hooking up the tonier customers. Even when power was available to the less affluent, the emergence of the electrical phonograph was followed by the Depression, and the weakest economic groups were less likely to run up electric bills they couldn't pay, at least more than once. This was even more true for those in rural areas where the Depression hit earliest. Many who bought the new phonographs gave their old windups to their servants. Radio was, and lots of people had servants in those days. Radio was cheaper and could be battery operated. And you didn't have to buy continual software upgrades. Two distinct markets for commercial records emerged, one for those with easy access to electrical power, and one for those whose power was generated by the elbow applied to the crank. Records of newer popular music were made with the required characteristics of one or the other market in mind. Even if not acoustic, some of the less expensive labels tailored their sound to reproduce well on the older technology, and many of the bargain labels addressing this market continued the acoustical process to avoid the royalty payable to Western Electric in addition to the music copyright fee, the mechanical royalty of 2 cents per side. Given the percentage add-ons of the distribution system, these royalties to Western Electric could mean a 35-cent record at retail had to sell at 40 cents, making it uncompetitive. What other reason could there be for the recording of major dance bands electrically for the flagship label than acoustically or with a different electrical sound for the dime store customers? A careful look at the couplings of hit tunes from this period as issued by the lower priced labels indicate that these were thought of by the marketers as single-sided discs with out of copyright, company owned, or easily negotiated copyrights from compliant publishers on the second side. The added cost of an electrical royalty for a product directed toward an audience where this process sounded badly on their machines was absurd. Most affected were race, blues, hillbilly, and some ethnic categories. This double market cries out for a strong research effort. But it is clear the star piano companies of the time were not cheaping out. They were pursuing a market neglected by the bigger guys. The software was capable of greater fidelity than the playback equipment initially marketed with it. It allowed a critical listener to believe, as has happened so frequently in the history of recording, that things were not as good as they could be and never would be as good as they turned out to be. It has taken us about 75 years to develop methods which show how well the old disc could sound, and we're still working on it. For research purposes, records function as artifacts as well as objects which can recreate sound. The trail was marked by discovery of these experimental discs, but only by hearing them did the startling dimension of the sonic advance they captured become apparent. The rest of this talk flowed from my astonishment. Listen to your records. This presentation is focused on some actual and perceptual changes in the recording industry during this transition period. In the interest of time, I have omitted a great deal. Roland Gillat's superb book, The Fabulous Phonograph, covers the overall picture quite well indeed, and Fenimore Johnson's biography of his father fills in much detail, though the two chapters devoted to this transition are among the most controversial in Reed and Welsh's From Tinfoil to Stereo. I ask that the discussion period avoid further elaborations on the story I've just told, which can be found in some of these reliable sources, unless they are relative to support or to counterpoints I've just made. Now that you're thoroughly intimidated, I'll take questions. Michael.
I just want to say that when I heard that particular Flying Dutchman recording, at the culmination of about 12 or 13 of these records, this one stood out head and shoulders in quality above the others. And so there was a
progress, and this is from the last sessions that they did record.
That was the last one in the pile that I had access to. But the other question is, where does the experiments of the Victor engineer Albertus Hewitt fit in? Because he was doing electrical recordings back into 1922 at Victor, and also using Victor's radio station as some of the signal source for some of his electrical recordings.
There's one important point to be made about, the short answer to your question is I'm not sure. As I say, this is a work in progress.
Yeah.
But the slightly longer answer is that at least of those experiments dealing with early electrical recording which I've heard, their quality at best approach that of decent acoustic recording.
Yeah.
This is the first system which was patently, in more than one sense, an improvement.
Yeah, but the point is, though, that Victor was doing experiments on electrical recording that was eventually shut down by the higher-ups. And I don't know whether it was shut down by the higher-ups because they now realized that Western Electric had a better system, or whether it was one of the things where they're saying, again, we don't want to go to this electrical recording business.
Well, Victor wasn't the only company doing this. Both American and English Columbia were working on their own in-house systems.
And I've heard the American Columbia recordings, and they are horrible.
That may be true.
Yes.
But there were also experiments going on in Europe, particularly in Germany. I'm sure that His Master's Voices folks were trying to improve the quality of their bark. I simply have, this is part of what remains to be determined, as does when other companies introduced their electrical systems, if they did so at all, before going to Western Electric. I know, for example, that the acoustical Taubers, which were recorded by Odeon, give out in late April 1926. They were still recording acoustically then. The next Tauber record is in November 1926, and at that point, it's electrical. The gap between the numbers is not very great. I assume that Odeon closed down for a while to retool, to reinstall equipment, rather than have an overlap. This is simply an assumption right now, and there are various discographic sources to be yet investigated. Jerry. Yes. They actually, as you go from disc to disc, the characteristics change as they keep evolving. And I think they first started working with treble. There's no significant bass in the really earliest experiments. But that doesn't mean that these were the earliest experiments. It's just the earliest ones we've found so far.
Remember, they also didn't have control over the microphones because that was the broadcast.
I do believe, however, that they did go into the hall and set up the microphones from the Western Electric people, because it's very clear in the case of the Dutchman and some of the other examples, even some of the earlier ones, that they were after specific attributes and set up their microphones to emphasize or to give them access to that while they were doing their tests. Do we have time for another question?
We need to go ahead and take a break.
Pardon?
We need to stay on schedule.
Okay, then I'll take the question personally.
Let me.
Sure.
Before we jump, I want to mention two things of significance to our schedule today. One of them is that your program says dinner will be served at 7:30. It will be served at 7. At 6:30, there will be an opportunity to have a cash bar if you care for a drink before dinner. Also, this coffee break... This coffee break and the lunch break will be your last chance to visit with people who have vendor tables. So if you care to go back and see Five Points or Kurt or Tim Fabrizio's book over here, this break plus the lunch break will be your last chance to do that. Thank you.